Last Word on Today FM.
John Gibbons, 200, not out. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, Matt. Yeah, it's 4.5 years going on, yeah.
Okay, listen, there's loads of comments and questions from listeners. I want to start with Elaine. I am not the problem. I don't drive. I recycle for Ireland. I watch water usage and I do maybe 2 return flights a year. None of that makes the slightest bit of difference compared to the damage the US, China, India, not to mention any number of huge companies and corporations are doing. So let me have my couple of breaks here and let me have my steak and chips without feeling guilty. What do you say to Elaine?
Yeah, well, first of all, Elaine, thanks for getting in touch. I think, yeah, this isn't really about feeling guilty. That really should not be the takeaway here. And I'll say this in the outset, and I'm sure we'll loop back to it, essentially about we're all in this pickle together, right? And I think the folks who are kind of interested in us not solving this problem, in other words, the interests that are kind of putting the brake on climate action, they want us to be feeling guilty and pointing fingers at one another. So I think Elaine has a point. Now, I'll counter that by saying that we in Ireland, we punch so far above our weight in terms of emissions. If you take it on a European level, we're probably, of the major countries, we're the number one per capita polluter in the entire European Union. That's despite, Matt, the progress that we've made in certain areas. Now, we can talk at length as to why we're so uniquely bad. But what that means is that your average Irish person is contributing about 12 tonnes a year of carbon to the global atmosphere. It's massive. So the population of Ireland is contributing the equivalent of about 300 million people in sub-Saharan Africa. So we may be small, but we have a big impact. So I don't accept the, you know, we've done too much. There is a kind of a narrative in Ireland that, you know, we're already put upon. This is one more thing. In fact, we're incredibly fortunate to live in a prosperous, safe country. And I think with that should come responsibility. And that responsibility is to do our full share in global equity. And that's a lot more than we're doing.
Well, John says, what is the one thing I could do today that would make a real difference?
Yeah, there's a few things I kind of was listing out in this, but we'll try to do one. And I'd say get political and so on, but I'll actually start, Matt, one back from that. And I would say it is get informed. And this is a curious thing. While everybody believes they understand this issue, I think, in fact, in many cases, that understanding is actually fairly superficial. And what that means is we tend to have a kind of a grasp of it, but then we see something on Facebook or we see a posting on Instagram and we go, oh, I'm not so sure about that. So it tends to blow with the wind. Now, there's nothing to be said, or there's nothing to be said against getting informed. And you start really, we need to read into this subject. And I don't mean Twitter posts. I mean, actually, you know, we need to start reading books. We need to start getting ourselves informed and going to good sources. That's really the critical thing here. There's no shortage of information, but there is a shortage of good quality information.
Well, then Adele says, what is the one fact or figure or stat that has surprised you and stuck with you the most over the years?
Yeah, well, first of all, there's loads of those, but I decided to narrow it down. But probably the one that really chilled me to the bone is this statistic about the world's mammals. And this is both land-based and marine mammals. If you took all the world's mammals and put them on the proverbial cosmic weighing scale.
Sorry, give me examples of mammals.
Mammals, ourselves, for example, elephants, you know, etc. So basically all the mammalian species, right?
Okay.
So the world's
all
mammals.
All humans, all animals, yeah. And things, whales.
All the mammals, right, of the world. Now, if you take all those mammals and weigh them on one side of the weighing scales, and then on the other side of the weighing scales, you take all the world's wild mammals, right? What you'd find is that by weight, 96% of the world's mammals by weight are either humans, our livestock, or our pets. Now, that is absolutely devastating. What that really says is, leave aside climate change, leave aside all that other stuff. One species has completely sequestered the face of the earth. And that is something that it's a very difficult thing for many people to come to terms with. It's a really difficult truth that we have essentially pushed most other species to the brink. And really, that number sticks firmly in my mind. I'll give you one other number.
Is that not survival of the fittest?
You see, I suppose the thing is, success isn't about exterminating all the creatures around you. That's not success. The creatures that actually have a long-term future on Earth, and the creatures that have been around for millennia and for millions of years, they're not the ones that destroy everything. They're the ones that are in harmony with their ecosystem. So the long-running species, for example, we take the millions of variants of insects, of the insect population, they date back about 400 million years. Now, how's that for evolutionary success? They've even survived things like the asteroid impact. So these are really tough species. And they're tough because they're adapted to their environment. I mean, they're not trying to destroy their environment. And the big issue really for us as a species is, yes, we've been tremendously successful, but unfortunately, we've done it at the cost of everything around us. Now, at some point, there's a reckoning. Well, it's pretty clear there's a reckoning coming at this from all kinds of ways. But essentially, we just have to come into balance with the world. And that really is something that we struggle to do, and so far we're not heading in that direction.
Steve in Wexford says, fair play to John Gibbons, he's on the right side of all the environmental issues, and time will prove this more and more. Stephen says, John, have you any good news for us? Is there nothing going on with governments, with business, with grassroots movements that makes you hopeful for the future? I enjoy you on with Matt every week, but unless you have some good news for us, you're basically doing a weekly countdown to our doom, and people will tune out.
Yeah, that's a risk. That, of course, is a risk. And I suppose, I see my job here, Matt, is to be a straight shooter as best I can on this. But to answer Stephen's question, yes, there are some really excellent stories, and we've covered them, many of them on the slot. For me, the standout story, particularly of the 2020s, has been the incredible rise and success of renewable energy. We've seen, for example, in 2004, it took a year to add 1 gigawatt of solar energy. And Matt, last year we were adding 1 gigawatt of solar energy globally every single day. So we increased solar energy output by 360-fold in 20 years. What that shows you is there is an unbelievable technologies are there to solve particularly the energy problem. There's no question. Unfortunately, they're also facing in political headwinds, because let's think about it. The companies, the organizations, and the states that have the most money and the most interest, if you like, in continuing the fossil fuel era, at the moment they're the ones with the deepest pockets, and they're the ones able to buy politicians, as we've seen so tragically in the US.
Okay, the nature of this is there are extra questions are coming in for listeners, and I'm thinking up extra questions as we're having the discussion, because it just strikes me on solar. Yes, if solar is a fantastic way to produce energy, doesn't it make sense to put all of the solar farms in places where the sun shines on a regular basis, rather than, say, in Ireland, replacing green fields where you can actually grow food, or you can have livestock to produce food, rather than putting the solar panels there, rather than in places like deserts and whatever?
Sure. Well, first of all, of course, the beauty of solar is that it's available locally. So the best thing about solar energy is you produce it close to where you need it. So having solar energy, and the curious thing, Matt, is here that the country in the world, certainly in the Northern Hemisphere, that really pioneered solar energy was the not particularly sunny Germany. And they did it through government intervention and through subsidies and supports. And as a result, the solar industry exploded, particularly in Germany. Within a few years, they had over 1 million households that had solar on their roofs. And what that did was it also drove down the cost of the development of solar technology, and then the Chinese got involved and so on. Here in Ireland, and again, I think we've touched on this before, but I'll reiterate briefly, if we were to meet our entire 2030 targets, Matt, for achieving about 8 gigawatts, which is huge, by the way, of solar energy on the Irish grid, we would need 0.25% of the farmland of Ireland. That's 0.25% of the farmland is all we need. And we get various scare stories about, oh, you're going to take up good agricultural land. It's round about the amount of land that we use for golf courses, right? So for context, nobody's talking about turning rural Ireland grey. And the thing here is, the key phrase in solar farm is the word farm. When you farm, you extract energy. Whether you extract it as kilocalories or kilowatts, it's all about extracting energy. You can then use that energy for other purposes. So I think many farmers, by the way, are extremely progressive about solar and realise, in fact, it offers them a fantastic commercial opportunity.
Dolores says, most people make a genuine effort to reduce waste and recycle at household level. Why aren't big companies doing their bit by at least using a minimum of packaging and making it recyclable?
Yeah, I think that is a massive problem. And of course, again, we've touched on this many times over the years, greenwashing, where companies put a great, tremendous effort into developing a good story about all the great things that they're doing. But the reality is that changing your systems to be genuinely sustainable and working within nature's limits, that is difficult. What's easy is to put out press releases saying all the amazing things that you're doing. So what we've seen is a huge amount of greenwashing, particularly from corporates, because ultimately, the corporations are driven by only one motive, as you well know, and that motive is the profit motive. They're under pressure. In fact, they're required by law to produce quarterly profits and so on. And that short-term thinking tends to override any sense of stewardship. And let's be honest, if you have two companies and one of them is environmentally careful and doesn't, you know, manages its waste stream efficiently and so on, the likelihood is the company, the dirty company down the road, will outcompete it, and the cleaner company, until we have rules in place, will actually go out of business.
Some people have, over the last week, texted in, and they're at it again tonight, wanting to know what you think of Ryanair getting rid of the €2 donation, the opt-in donation when you're booking a flight, as sort of a carbon offset. What do you think of that? Because Ryanair does something else this week, invested €500 million in buying new engines, which it says are less pollutant than the existing engines they have in their aircraft.
Sure. Take those one at a time. The first one is the so-called offset, the €2 offset. It was a complete irrelevance. Offsetting what? Money going to where? The whole thing. In fact, their uptake, Matt, at the best of times, and O'Leary said as much, was about less than 1%.
So it was a useless
thing. It was gesture politics from a company that is not in the slightest bit interested in greening.
Maybe it is interested, because it's made €500 million investment in new engines, which it says will be far more fuel efficient, and that will be better for the environment.
It would, if there were limits on the amount of flying that we're going to do, then having more efficient engines, you're absolutely right, they would reduce the amount of impact of a company like Ryanair. But it's important to understand that the atmosphere only responds to one thing, Matt, and that is the gross amount of stuff we dump into it. So Ryanair can talk all day long about efficiency, but what matters is how many millions of tons of carbon dioxide and nitrous oxide is that airline dumping into the atmosphere this year, next year and the year after. If you track that instead of the PR, what you find is that curve is bending upwards, because they're flying. They have a cheaper aircraft. So what do? They lower emissions, fine, great. They put on more flights, they reduce the ticket price, and we get more aviation. And the net effect is that pollution goes up.
Listener has just sent one in. When was the last time John Gibbons went on a plane, example, for a holiday? How many times a year? He says, congratulations to you on your 200th show. When were you last on an aircraft and why?
Yeah, I was last on an aircraft in September of last year to go to a family wedding in London, right? So I try, and I'm not perfect, I try to keep aviation to one flight a year where possible. I'm not saying I'm going to achieve it every year. And again, Matt, things that we've talked about in this show is that I'm in favour of a rationing system for aviation so that we all get a fair crack of the whip. Nobody, by the way, again here, should be in the business of pointing fingers and saying, well, you did this, too much of that, and the other. Now, I don't intend, you know, doing the thing of flying 10 or 20 times a year, because first of all, it's unfair, and second of all, by and large, it's unnecessary.
Okay, another one here, without giving a name, says, what's the most important environmental issue facing us all today? And adds, give an example of how life for my 3-year-old will be different in 30 years if we don't collectively make the necessary changes now.
Yeah, they're obviously, those questions are related. So, I mean, clearly for me, the number one issue isn't really climate change. I think climate change should be seen more as a symptom. Climate change is kind of like the exhaust fumes of an overheated industrial civilization. That's maybe the best way to think of it. And the climate change is the accumulation of the waste products of a civilization that is doing too much, flying too much, consuming too much, traveling too much. We've got to figure out a way, equitably, by the way. And by the way, when I say civilization, of course, there's 8 billion people in the world, and about 6 billion of them are doing none of these things. This is very much an issue for the wealthier parts of the world, including Europe.
John, so do you know what your problem is going to be there, though? Of those 6 billion who have never flown, and it's more than that, or who have never eaten meat, or who have very limited access to protein, they actually want what the rest of us have. Their ambition is to have that. And rather than actually phasing it out, I think you're going to find that there are more and more people who want to fly. I mean, this is why they're talking about, essentially by 2015, airlines are talking about doubling nearly the amount of people who fly in a particular year. I think it's about 4.2 billion trips taken per annum at present. That'll go to 8 billion by 2050.
Yeah, and that comes right back to your earlier point about Ryanair. None of them are committed to reducing emissions. What they're committed to is more flying, more planes, more emissions, more environmental
breakdown. Well, I think they'll argue that they can actually, even with doubling the numbers flying, they'll be able to reduce reduce the emissions.
Well, they can argue, but there's no evidence to support the argument. This is the issue.
Sustainable aviation fuel?
Well, good luck with that. Again, we've talked about that. Yeah. SAF's less than 1% of the gross fuel, and you could use all the area given over to growing corn in the United States of America to produce a fraction of the sustainable aviation fuel that we need.
Or maybe they'll find a different type of fuel, a different way of producing it. Okay, here's a really interesting question. Here's a surprise one for you, okay? This comes from a listener, which I think is a really good one. What aspects or elements of your own lifestyle or carbon footprint are you unhappy about and which needs improvement?
Okay, I guess this comes back to the personal again. Let me see. I still drive a car, right? It's an electric car, sure, but I still drive a car. What else? I'm not hugely unhappy with it. I've cut down on travel and so on. But again, what we're doing...
Are you careful about even... what you eat, for example? Would you eat an avocado that's flown in from Mexico?
I'm not a huge avocado person, I'll be totally honest, but I'm also not one of those people who goes pouring through the contents of their plate to see what's on it.
But if you were having a glass of wine, would you buy a bottle of wine from France rather than New Zealand on the basis that it hasn't travelled as far?
Perhaps. However, what's important to understand is that the food miles aspect of the carbon embedded in products is far, far smaller than the products themselves. The carbon related to the product is way more important. So the avocado from Mexico, the likely carbon content of that is probably a lot lower than the ham from Dungarvan. That's the reality of it. So, you know, we focus on food miles, but when you look at the data behind food miles, you find, in fact, it's a colourful distraction.
John, listener here, Blake says, you're making a nice career out of being a doom merchant. This isn't your career as such. You're not doing this to make money. You have your own successful business, don't you?
That's right, Matt. Yeah. If you, there's an old joke you might have heard about it. If you want to be a millionaire in the airline business, you start out a billionaire, right? And if you want to be a millionaire in the climate journalism business, you better start out a billionaire too. There is no money in this. Anyone who knows anything about journalism will understand that, and you, Matt, better than most. Absolutely. So no, I'm in the fortunate position that I've run a publishing related business for the last 30 years plus, and that has allowed me the ability to actually concentrate and put a lot of time that if I had to pay for it, it'd be impossible for me to take the kind of time that's required to look into and to understand and to speak about and to advocate about for these environmental issues. So in a sense, that tax, I'm taxing my own time and I'm taxing my own income by saying, you know what, I feel a duty to do what I do. And I don't want to sound pious in saying that, Matt, but I feel an absolute duty to be here and to be having these conversations with anyone who listen.
Okay, stay with us, John. We need to take a break and we'll continue this extended 200th edition of The Last Word on the Environment with John Gibbons.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Welcome back. Okay, John, how do you stay positive when it seems there's always doom and gloom with you?
Yeah, I think the way I think about this, Matt, is it's a huge privilege to be alive now. It really is, because there's still everything to play for. And I suppose on a personal level, I guess I focus on my kids and try to think about the situation that we're leaving for them. I think as every parent does, we all think about our kids, we think about the future, we think about our legacy. So from my point of view, that keeps me focused and keeps me positive. It is easy to get down in the mouth about this stuff, but it doesn't really, that doesn't move the dial. You have to be constructive. You have to really look it in the eye.
Donald says, this is the biggest bull ever. I will never stop flying and I fly 10 times a year. The earth has always changed. This is just a moment in time and people will evolve to live with it.
Yeah, unfortunately, Donald's talking completely. That's not Donald Trump.
No, it's
chance.
Not. No. He's given his full name in fairness. Yeah. But anyway, it's not.
Yeah, again, I don't want to eat into too much time on that, Matt. I mean, essentially, the science is unfortunately crystal clear on this. Earth changes in response to what are called forcings, and the biggest forcing now are man-made forcings. So we're changing the climate system. It's happening in real time. For example, 2024 was the hottest year on the instrumental record. 2023 was the hottest year before that. These are not coincidences. This is not some kind of cyclical pattern. And I think it's important that we own this thing. Now, if Donald wants to fly, if he wants to take that nihilistic view and he wants to fly 10, 20 times a year, that's his decision. But what I'm hearing from Donald, in fact, is a guilty conscience.
Mark in Waterford says, you're away with the fairies if you believe that ham from Dungarvan has a higher carbon footprint than avocado. The bigger picture, including the sheer volume of water needed to grow avocado, and another listener making a similar point, that avocados take an enormous amount of watering, and that's where the real danger is.
Sure. Again, the biggest impacts we have, and this is just a fact, I'm sorry to say, in relation to our food systems, the biggest impacts that we have are when we first of all route that food through the digestive system of animals, right? And when we eat food in a secondary way. That's just a simple, that's just a fact. There are some foods that are higher impact than others. You know, potatoes from Mexico are probably lower impact again.
Okay, we have another one here. I just don't get why most of your messages are from people who insist on living in denial and who want to argue with John. What do people not get? This is a climate crisis. Stop trying to pretend it's not. Desperately sad statistic about the mammals we've wiped out. And here's another one from Niamh Tobin. How can normal people stop the industrial fishing? Do we have to stop eating fish?
Yeah, that's a very good point from Niamh. We have a massive problem globally with fishing. And this isn't, by the way, your local fisherman going out and taking, you know, a modest catch. This is industrialised, heavily subsidised to the tune of billions of dollars a year globally, subsidised industrial fishing craft that are going out and emptying the world's oceans of fish. We talked about this recently in relation to krill and indeed here locally in Ireland in relation to sprat. And of course, for the industrial fishers, they put nothing in, and they take everything out. And they have no difficulty with emptying the world's oceans of fish. And you might say, well, are they not destroying their future? They don't care, because they can turn fish into money and they can turn money into other stuff. And unfortunately, that's the way large-scale industries think. It's an extractive industry. Remember, the industrial fishing put nothing back into the oceans. They're simply taking.
Okay, this is a really good one from Dio Sullivan. Why does every solution to climate change result in less money in people's pockets? I think that's a really important question, because I think an awful lot of people feel that the measures that they've been asked to bring into their lives will lead to a reduced standard of living for them.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, and I really was thinking about this, and I thought about some of the items, for example, and we touched on it earlier, solar PV. Put some PV panels on your roof, and next thing, you're saving money. In fact, you may even be making money. So that's one.
Does that really happen, though? Do you really make money? Are you able to sell electricity back?
Oh, yeah, you sell it back to the grid for about 20 cents a kilowatt hour. Friends of mine put panels on the roof about 2 months ago, and in the month of May alone, just with panels on one side of the roof, they produced about a megawatt hour of electricity. So it is, and they're also exporting most of that back to the grid, because it's far more than they need themselves. Another thing, Matt, in terms of all these green things costing you money, we have a high electricity cost in Ireland for all kinds of reasons, but they'd be far higher were it not for the fact that we have a large chunk of offshore wind on our grid. And also, of course, if you want to save money and you're motoring, the most economical thing to do would be to buy, preferably secondhand, an electric car. It'll run on a fraction of the cost of what you're putting in servicing and in petrol or diesel into your internal combustion car.
But what about the environmental footprint of the manufacture of that electric car, particularly the extraction of rare earth minerals for the battery?
Yeah, again, the numbers have been done on these, and we know, for example, that while an EV has a slightly higher environmental impact in terms of its production, the real impact is what's called the total lifetime of ownership. And typically, an EV is about 60% less emissions over its entire lifetime. So it offsets the slightly higher emissions in production by drastically lower emissions in its usage.
James in Wexford says, cut the population. Dean in Cork says, what does John feel about the population of the planet and that we are way oversubscribed? Should we stop having kids?
Yeah, tough questions. Oftentimes the population issue comes up, and for example, it is again important to understand that the world's poorest people are contributing the least to the issue. So I would say that overall impacts are a combination of population, affluence and technology. There's a sort of a mathematical equation that works that out. That's why, for example, big countries with big populations and lots of affluence like the US have colossal carbon impacts. So 300 million people producing, using a huge share of the world's resources. So population by itself, I don't believe is the critical thing. I think the critical thing is equity. And that's really the missing part in this.
Here's a great one here from Laura, and never knew this. She says, great show, thanks to you and John for covering this topic so often. You mentioned wine and sustainability. For your information, the biggest carbon footprint relating to wine is actually the glass bottle, over 50% of the carbon dioxide footprint. So when buying wine, the most effective thing you can do is the lightest possible bottle.
Sure.
Never thought of that.
Yeah, or indeed,
But surely the glass bottle is better than plastic container bottles.
I would think so.
Not that you get wine in plastic container bottles.
Sure.
Unless you're very cheap.
I suppose really, like if you go back to what we used to do with milk bottles in Ireland not that long ago, certainly when I was a kid, you wash them out, the creamery picked them up, they reuse them. And we need to stop recycling and we need to start reusing. And glass, by the way, can be reused if it's handled correctly, it can be reused successfully. Thousands of times.
Here's another one. Kevin says, what does John think of heat pumps now? Was it all hot air?
Well, as a heat pump user, I'm very enthusiastic about heat pumps. I think I'm about 2 years in, Matt, with my heat pump. It works extremely well. It just works. They're a very comfortable house. The electrical costs are what they are. It's comparable to running a gas boiler. But the big difference is you're not producing all those emissions. And I'm really, really happy about that.
Okay, do we not need to reduce, says Niall Jackson, the use of potable water for things like car washing, gardening, etc.? Do water charges not make more sense now than ever to reduce waste and to protect valuable finite resource?
Do you know, I was having that very thought the other day. Every time we go to the loo and we flush the water, and we flush the loo, we're flushing away highly processed, safe drinking water. People in third world countries would look in horror at the fact that in Ireland we're using this pristine water, which, by the way, has been purified at a cost running into billions, right? And then what do we do with it? We put it into a cistern, pull the lever and flush it down into the sewage system, which is crazy. Of course, and in some countries, for example, you have things like where they use the wastewater from your dishwasher or from your clothes washer and use that water, what they call grey water, Matt, is used instead. For example, let's say you divert the water from your shower, which is now grey water, it's got suds in it, that stuff will flush your toilet every bit as well. So I think we need to get much, much more clever about water use. And people in Ireland, especially on a day like today where it's spilling rain, think, well, don't be ridiculous. We have no shortage of water. In the east coast of Ireland, we're facing a real acute water crisis. We're going to have to spend billions of euros to address that, either with new facilities on the east coast or transferring water across.
Yeah, so, are you in favour of transport? 3% of the River Shannon is the suggestion of the money that is of the water that is needed for the greater Dublin region. Would you be in favour of that diversion of water?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the population on the East Coast needs access to more water. And of course, I hear people already saying we need to fix all those pipes. But a lot of those pipes go back to Victorian times. And if you want to dig up the entirety of Dublin and have constant chaos for the next 25 years and spend billions, the reality is we have an old Victorian era system. It is leaky. We can do better. But we are going to need more water supply. And we have probably at times too much water in the Shannon. So taking a couple of percent out of the Shannon region is probably okay.
It's a national resource as well.
It is.
Listener says, love listening to John. Intelligent and interesting. The comments texted in sometimes make me furious though. Well, sometimes it's because the texters are furious about what John has been saying. Here's one that says, when is John going to stop giving Irish farmers a hard time?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think...
And just for those who may be new to you, you do come from a farming background originally. You grew up on a farm.
I did indeed, yeah. So I consider I have a reasonably good understanding of agriculture and that background, as you say, Matt. I guess the issue really here is about 40% of our emissions in Ireland come from agriculture. It's a relatively small part of our economy, despite what people think. It's about 6% of our economy, producing 40% of our emissions. But within that, the livestock sector is grossly oversized and is producing, through methane alone, about two-thirds of that 40%. So it's a massive overproducer. So we're talking about really a tiny, on a national level, a tiny number of people benefiting and yet at a massive carbon cost to Ireland. And we've talked about these recently. We're looking down the barrel of fines coming our way of between, 8 and 26 billion euros. And nobody seems to be asking the very reasonable question, should the people who benefit from these emissions also be paying the emissions tallies? And as you know, we do not tax carbon emissions out of agriculture, which is one of the reasons why we have some of the most carbon-intense agricultural systems in Europe. Now, that isn't an anti-agriculture remark. That is just a factual, positional statement. And our agricultural systems are simply out of whack. They're overloaded with, particularly with dairy and beef. And we're major importers, Matt. 85% of all the food you'll find in an Irish shop or supermarket, 85% is imported. So, you know, you might say, well, who's feeding the people of Ireland? The reality is most of the food that we eat arrives in this country on ships. It is not being produced domestically. And that is something that worries me enormously. You know, in an era of climate breakdown, in an era of political instability, I think it's an extremely risky, dangerous proposition to have a system where we're exporting to luxury middle-class markets most of our beef and dairy products on the one hand, and on the other hand, depending on imports of everything from animal feed to fertilizers to the very food that we eat from countries, many of which, by the way, are really struggling with food production. We've seen, for example, crops in Morocco, vegetable production in Spain being hammered by climate change. And yet we in Ireland are sitting here going, well, I'm sure somebody will provide our food. And we do have this idea that it's being produced domestically. And I'm sorry to say, but it's not.
Here's a question that's come in from Cian in Leitrim. Why is saving the oceans so important when we live on land?
Sure. I guess, well, the oceans, of course, are the cradle of life. We also know, for example, that without the carbon that is drawn down by the oceans, in other words, as humans emit vast amounts of carbon dioxide, about between 40 and 50 billion tons a year, most of the heat from that has been drawn down into the oceans. About 90% is. If it wasn't for that ameliorating role of the oceans, the surface temperature of the Earth would already have killed off pretty much all life on the planet. So in the short term, the oceans have been, they've acted as a colossal carbon buffer. They've protected life on land from the impacts. However, all that CO2 that the oceans have mopped up, Matt, is increasing the acidification of the oceans. And we're seeing that, for example, in the breakdown of coral reefs and so on. And essentially, when marine animals can no longer form shells, then the marine food system breaks down. And that is a direct result of the carbon dioxide that we emit on land. So land and sea, the cycles are intimately connected.
Okay, there's a lot of farmers coming in. Pat in Tipperary says, I think John will find that a lot of Irish powdered milk feeds literally millions of Nigerian babies. There are a lot of people pointing out that about 140,000 people in this country depend on not just farming, but the byproducts, the work in manufacturing, food processing, whatever, food and alcohol, that we have enormous amount of the economy is dependent on agriculture.
Can I start with Nigerian babies? Why would Nigerian babies be drinking Irish powdered milk? Why wouldn't they be drinking, for example, breast milk from Nigerian mothers? Can you explain why we think that we're providing an alternate bovine product for something that's produced by Nigerian mothers and always has been? And, for example, 50 years ago, do you think Nigerian mothers, who do you think was feeding Nigerian babies milk? So that's a crazy argument.
What about the fact that it was 140,000 plus people whose livelihoods depend on the agriculture sector in Ireland?
Well, of course, we have a significant agriculture sector, but we have many different economic sectors in Ireland, and no one of them should have a, if you like, an arm lock on how we operate in Ireland.
Another listener says the ocean is a giant carbon sink. Here's another one. Are you a vegetarian?
No, I'm not a vegetarian, no.
Why not?
Well, maybe I should be, but I'm not a vegetarian. I avoid red meat, and I avoid it because it's based on ruminant agriculture. So we know, for example, beef and sheep in particular, they're ruminant animals, and they're huge methane producers. The meat that I tend towards is chicken. Chicken is much lower impact from an ecological point of view. Yes, there are issues with chickens, don't get me wrong, but I haven't got to that point yet. You see, I'm not here presenting myself as Mr. Pure and the Oracle. I'm not here wearing hemp clothing, Matt, as you might have noticed, right? I have an iPhone here in my hand. I live in the real world, just like your listeners. And none of us are here to say how holier we are and to shining up our halos, and myself included.
Yeah, I think you've just answered a question that's just come in from another listener. Is he for real? He's very much for real. It's John Gibbons. 200 not out to the next 100. We look forward to seeing you each Thursday here on The Last Word of Dave. And thank you to all the listeners. I've only gotten to a fraction of the messages and questions that have been tumbling in since we started this just over a half an hour ago on tonight's show.
The Last Word
on Today FM.